Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, September 11th, 2001. Four hijacked planes, two brought down the World Trade Center, one rammed into the Pentagon, one crashed in a Pennsylvania field. 2,973 people died. Today, we remember.
Marines, wake up right now. Turn on the TV. The World Trade Center has been destroyed. The Pentagon has been attacked. Turn on the news.
Another plane just flew in. The explosion is incredible. Oh my god.
Today we've had a national tragedy.
Aircraft penetrated deep inside the Pentagon.
The city of New York and the United States of America is much stronger than any group of barbaric terrorists.
They have bomb squads out here checking all of our gear.
What we do know is that no just cause can be advanced by terror.
I'm going to call the FAA conference call. There are no planes taking off in the entire country.
Hi, are you there? Jack? Pick up, sweetie. Okay, well, I just wanted to tell you I love you. We're having a little problem on the plane. I just love you more than anything. Just know that. Bye, honey.
And if you go over by there, you can see the people jumping out the window. They're jumping out the window right now. Oh, my God.
And we will not rest until this evil is driven from our world.
Make no mistake about it, your armed forces are ready.
I can hear you, the rest of the world hears you, and the people who knock these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
Right now we're all alone. The second building came down. I can't see.
Melissa, can you hear me? Melissa? Melissa? Oh my God. Melissa, please. Melissa?
Joining me today from Stanford, California, is David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford University. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2000 for his book Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. David Kennedy, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is political demographer Ben Wattenberg. He's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, moderator of the PBS show Think Tank. Since the days of the Vietnam War, he has often argued America is better off than its critics contend. Ben Wattenberg, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom, and welcome to David, who I believe was a guest on our special called The First Measured Century, and whose books I have read with great enjoyment and admiration.
David, Ben, also joining us from Concord, Massachusetts, is Doris Kearns Goodwin, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II, and most recently, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Ben, and hi, David.
Hi, Doris. We are also former colleagues going back to the LBJ White House.
I'm afraid, long way back.
and you've written on my sometimes favorite topic on baseball, and they're wonderful books.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Here we are.
Are we on the air now?
We're very much on the air,
okay,
Ben,
great. Hi,
David,
everybody.
Doris. On a day that has lots of Americans looking back, and with 5 years of vantage now, trying very hard to look forward as well, I want to turn to each of you for just a moment, if I may, If you could kind of just collect your thoughts about your first reaction 5 years ago, and when you look back on that reaction today, how your perspective on 9/11 has changed. Doris, may I come first to you?
You know, I think at the time it seemed like nothing would ever be the same for our entire country. There was that sense of shocked vulnerability matched only in a single day by Pearl Harbor. And I suspect that partly because of knowing the enormous change that Pearl Harbor made on every aspect of our country's life, I would have expected the same thing to have happened for 9/11. And it did for a period of time. It brought us together. It created a sense of unity, a sense of common resolve. And then yet, as we can talk about, things certainly have changed since that point. And I'm more surprised now that we're back to a state of normality than I would have ever guessed on September 11th for most of the people in the country, other than that inner circle who were absolutely affected by it.
David Kennedy, we're going to dig into the historical context, how the American response has been like and unlike its response to other great challenges. But just first, your thoughts as you recall them then and now, you sort of... fundamental perspective on that day, that morning, and how it looks to you 5 years on.
Well, my reaction 5 years ago was very similar to Doris's, that the extraordinary drama of that day of September 11th, 2001, is unforgettable. But the Pearl Harbor analogy suggests itself very strongly, of course. But 5 years after Pearl Harbor would have been December 7th, 1946, World War II would have been concluded well over a year earlier, and that phase, that great dramatic element or act of history had been completed. And we're still very much in the midst of this war on terror, if that's the proper name for it. So I share Doris's feeling that we were misled, I think, as a people. I don't mean by anyone in particular, but by the drama of the event 5 years ago, into thinking that an entirely new era had opened up. But We're in for a longer struggle than World War II, it appears, and the proper analogy may not be World War II itself, but the Cold War, which went on for nearly five decades.
Ben Wattenberg, your first response 5 years ago today, and how do you look back on it now, yours and the country's?
Well, I was on my way to give a speech in Norfolk, Virginia, and I called my agent, and I said, I ain't gone, no matter what. Of course, there's no way you could have gone anyway. And I don't know whether I disagree with Doris and David or not, but an awful lot of people have been saying we have lost in Iraq. And I would cordially, I hope, disagree. I mean, you have had elections, you have a constitution, you have a parliament, you have security forces, which, according to my very first research assistant Carl Zinsmeister here at AI, who has been in embed four times and was almost killed, that the security forces are getting better each time he goes. And you have what may be the defining image of the early part of the 21st century, Arab women waving that purple finger. And just as a final note, stop me if I'm going too fast. My sister, who is an actress, Rebecca Schull, who was just in that movie Flight 93, which was shot in England without a script. And she's, I won't tell you whether she's older or younger than I, but she's a wonderful woman.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, it's interesting. Here we are 5 years after, and before we can even get through the introductions, Iraq is in the middle of our conversation about attacks on Manhattan and the Pentagon that did not originate in Iraq. What do you make of the centrality of Iraq 5 years on to what happened on that day?
You know, I think one of the things to think about is what would have happened, and I think historians love to do this, the path not taken, if we had not gone into the war of Iraq as our response eventually to 9/11, if instead we had really prepared ourselves at home for another potential emergency, as they did in World War II with auxiliary fire and police, block captains, aircraft spotters, really part of preparedness. Would we have been better able to deal with Katrina? You know, what would have happened if the Public Health Service had been substantially strengthened in case of a biological attack, but it would have been a good thing in itself? What would have happened if the monies that went into Iraq had gone into a Manhattan Project for alternative energy, so that we might be closer today to really having independence from Middle Eastern oil than we have? Now, what if we had had, just as we did after Sputnik, put some of that money into cultural exchanges and language training and intelligence professionals, a whole new cadre? You know, there's just ways of thinking about how Iraq did become the central response in our imagination in terms of lives, in terms of money, to 9/11, whether or not it had a direct connection or not, it was the administration's response. And I think it is what we think about now when we think about 9/11, even though it didn't necessarily have to be that way.
David Kennedy, you've looked at a lot of wars and challenges. Are you surprised at where the country stands 5 years after this one? Are you surprised with the centrality of Iraq, with the nature of the American conversation 5 years on?
Well, yes, I am. And I would add to Doris's list, incidentally, Afghanistan, that had we not diverted such massive military resources to Iraq, we would have had a larger, more effective force on the ground in Afghanistan, and that country would be much more secure today, I believe. But listen, my mind actually goes back, as we carry on this conversation, even back before 9/11-2001, to the 2000 presidential campaign, when then-candidate George W. Bush said rather famously by now that he thought the United States, as it faced the international system, the international community, should be a humble nation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think
humble
anyone...
Humble is the way they pronounce it in Texas, right? Go ahead.
Humble, okay.
Yeah.
But in any case, I don't think anybody around the world today would describe the United States as behaving humbly.
President Bush, just not long at all after the attacks of 9/11, quoted FDR famously about the unity of Americans would feel in the face of challenge. As you say, by this time, 5 years after Pearl Harbor, the war had been won. We were well past that already. This time we're not. But what about when you look at the response of the first, I don't know how, what period you want to give it, the first year, the first 2 years, how do you see it as in line with America's traditional, if the World War II response can be called traditional response to challenge, how do you see it as different?
Well, there's actually quite a sharp contrast between the first year or so after 9/11 and the first year or so after Pearl Harbor. And it owes largely, I think, to the nature of this conflict and to the changes in technology over the last six decades. But World War II was a total war that mobilized the resources of the society right down to the last nail and toothpick. And millions of men brought under arms, almost 16 million by the war's end. And a total mobilization of the economy to wage the conflict. Today, the armed forces proportionate to population are about 1/25th the size of the force we fielded in World War II. And we're able to wage this war essentially without breaking much of a sweat economically. The draw on resources from the society at large to fight this conflict is really quite amazingly small given the size of the economy. The Pentagon budget, including the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, amounts to only about 4% of gross domestic product, whereas in World War II it was about 40%.
Wow.
So we're as a society, we're able to do these things, for better or worse, on the very margins of our resources without making deep impacts on our society or its economy.
Ben Wattenberg, just on that point, has that made the country more or less united, successful in its response, the fact that we can do it with one hand tied behind our back, or are we doing it?
Well, just as a point of information, I'm not a demographer. I am an alleged demographic expert. I think that the amount of monies that we have spent in a $13 trillion economy and growing is chump change. The reason we haven't sacrificed, and I remember World War II where we had ration points and all that kind of stuff, is we haven't needed to. And if there was some phony baloney sacrifice, President Bush would really catch hell. And finally, the idea that this is a, and you hear it as sort of a neoconservative Jewish war, I think is baloney. I mean, the sort of foreign policy that we have now, I think, goes back to my hero, St. Henry M. Scoop Jackson, who blended, as Wilson did, but I think more successfully, realism with idealism. And the idea that we have not been hit again by a terrorist attack, because asymmetrical warfare is almost impossible to stop, is almost up there with the idea that we have not shot off a nuclear weapon in 60 years in anger. So I think, and here the stock market, with all this turmoil, is going sort of sideways, near record high. We had a member of the press from the United Kingdom in recently. They said people around the world are saying, Yankee, go home and take me with you.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, this issue of sacrifice comes to the fore. Whether we needed more or not, Ben Wattenberg says it's chump change what we spent. On the other hand, and if you look out there, Bin Laden's not caught, Afghanistan not secured, Iraq, I mean, by many measures, Ben's observation notwithstanding, sort of tempting at least, a Mideast meltdown by the U.S. military's own standards. What about the sacrifice Americans have made in terms of its volume and in terms of whether or not, you know, its relative absence has been good for the country?
Well, you know, I think the problem with the relative absence, excuse me, of sacrifice, not only of sacrifice, but of shared participation, is that when a war goes on long, as this one has, you begin to see the support for it dropping out. You know, I keep wondering what would have happened if, even if we didn't have a draft for this war, if there'd been a real desire to have more people enter the armed forces. At the time, the Pentagon wanted a smaller, more mobile force. Would our ranks be stretched so thin in Iraq now? Maybe the reservists' lives wouldn't have been so disrupted. So if right after September 11th there'd been a concerted effort to ask for much more volunteers, maybe things would have been easier.
But they've recruited like crazy in the years since, and it, as you well know, it's been a huge struggle.
And it's been a huge struggle. That's what I mean. But at that time, you know, after September 11th, when there was that patriotic thing, I think more people, if there was an effort, might well have been entering into the armed forces. And the problem with the lack of shared action is that whereas in earlier wars, everyone knew someone who was fighting, so you had this continual conversation. Now it still seems sometimes as if, you know, they're fighting over there. We see a few people die. I feel so badly for the parents and the families of those who've died in Iraq with nowhere near the attention given to them, even as those who died in 9/11. We saw those New York Times biographies of every single person who died in 9/11. Mm-hmm. Where have the similar ones be for the soldiers who've died in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Doris, Ben, David, I want to begin to turn to our listeners. Gordon's calling from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Gordon, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. It seemed to me that 9/11 was an opportunity for the world to come together and together get rid of the fear of terrorism and strengthen America's place in the world as a trusted idealistic leader. Instead, Bush used 9/11 to stir up hatred and nationalism and build up the military with huge deficits. And we abandoned Afghanistan, which is we should have stayed there and helped that poor country and give them an opportunity for a real life. Instead, we went into Iraq and put our resources there. America seems more and more like Germany to me in the 30s. People in Savannah, where I live, the conservatives, the Republicans, don't want to hear the naysayers like me, the critics.
Gordon, do you see something turning? Do you see 5 years on now, do you see the national attitude turning? Do you see an opportunity for a different approach?
I don't trust Americans anymore. I really think they're blind. I think more and more about liquidating my assets and leaving this country, going to Canada or New Zealand or someplace where people are normal and down to earth and have some common sense.
There's an incredibly bleak view. Gordon, thanks for calling. David Kennedy, how do you hear that with your ear pressed against the history of how Americans responded in earlier decades?
Well, Gordon's point reminds me of a dinner conversation to which I was a party the other night to some people who had just come back from 2-3 months in Europe, and they said they were repeatedly welcomed in Europe the way people in this country used to welcome Soviet scientists who visited the Cold War, that they were extended personal respect and civility and so on. But there was an undertone of feeling of pity that these people came from such a sorry society as the United States. And whether that's a widespread reaction or not, who knows? But the fact is that the that great fund of goodwill that this country enjoyed in the world for at least two decades after World War II, particularly in Europe, has been drawn down. That account's been drawn down to just about zero. And there's a generation now coming to power in Europe, especially, that has little or no memory of that historical role the United States played. And I think, though Gordon's view may be a wee bit exaggerated, I think he's certainly onto something, that the soft power, so-called, associated with the goodwill that this society could count on in the international community has largely been drawn down to just about zero.
Ben Wattenberg, we let that pass by sometimes, but it may be hugely consequential in what may be at heart, many now say, a war of ideas. America was long a beacon of idealism. Now we look at the polls around the world, and there's incredible disenchantment. Wherever you come from politically, you can't miss what the polls say. What about that? Is that a gaping hole in the side of American strength?
No, I don't think so. I think the first of all, there was a poll taken by a group headed by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. The survey was taken in Iraq, and it showed that 70% of the people believed in a secular democratic representative government. The one of the principal,
but let's look at the whole planet. I mean, whether you look in the UK or Germany around. I mean, the numbers are just shocking.
Well, look, the United States still has the reserve currency, which not backed by gold. Not that that mattered much. We give people pieces of paper. They hoard them. They return to us goods and services. They emigrate here, and you know that fog of war thing that people talk about. I mean, if the media was like it was in World War II today, I don't believe we could have fought that war. If David or Doris could correct me, I believe the USS Indianapolis, a cruiser, was bombed by friendly fire, and 900 sailors were killed. And we created sort of phony heroes, Colin Kelly bombing the Haruna and things like that.
You think the American media has created the world's disenchantment? Is that what you're saying?
Pardon me?
Do you think the American media has created the world's disenchantment as represented in polls around?
I don't. Yes, but I don't believe the world is disenchanted by the United States. I mean, English or American, as I prefer, has become the first universal language.
But doesn't that just fly right in the face when people are asked what they think of the United States? The numbers have just fallen very precipitously. Now, we've got the reserve currency, so are you saying you'd rather be feared than loved? We've got the financial power, at least for now?
It's down in some places. It's up in places like
very
India.
Few.
I think more than you think. It's up in India. I believe it's up in Australia. And, you know, My late colleague and co-author, Richard M. Scammon, who was sort of maybe the world's leading cephalologist, he studied elections, said that foreign policy was sort of, whether it showed up in the polls or not, was sort of the hidden issue of every American election. Americans wanted to see this, their man in the White House was a take-charge guy.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, let me put the same question to you, this issue of American standing in the world, American idealism as long a magnet. Is it still working? And if it's not, what does that suggest?
Well, you know, for such a long period of time, America was not simply a country, but it really was an idea that this was a place where life could be made better, where opportunities were open, where there was a seemingly classless society. I mean, all of it never being completely true, and a sense where when we ventured abroad, we didn't occupy countries, we simply freed them. And even if one grants that the Bush administration, in its later rationale of creating a democratic government in the midst of the Middle East, represented their own sort of idealism, then sadly the failure to deal with that once we got over there, past the mission accomplished, prevent the looting, have enough soldiers on the ground to make life better for the Iraqis on a daily basis, rather than allowing perhaps the insurgency to reach the point it has, that's what people are seeing. So the original notion of whatever they thought they were going in there for, and not being able to convince the Allies that it was a notion worth their fighting for, you know, in the end, the president's great responsibility when you send your sons and daughters to war is to keep the country believing in your belief. And whatever, President Bush has to take responsibility for the fact that the majority of the country, even here, thinks it was a mistake to go into Iraq, and the majority thinks that we shouldn't be there now. And if he thinks that's wrong, and he does, and that's perfectly right of him to do so, it's his responsibility to educate and shape public opinion to his point of view, and so far that hasn't worked.
Let me take a call from Columbia, South Carolina. David's on the air. Hi, David.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think?
First of all, I want to say about 9/11 that it's an unbelievable tragedy that the world paid attention to and felt sympathy for us, and we used that properly in going to Afghanistan. We had no choice. Any leader worth any salt would have done exactly that. The problem is that we sent 25,000 soldiers there. We sent 130,000 to Iraq. Iraq was definitely a neocon plan. They thought in advance. They wanted to do it. This gave them an opportunity. Where did the leadership lead the country at that point? That's the real tragedy.
David, here we are 5 years on. As David Kennedy says, World War II was well and done by then. Where do you see the American story turning now from your vantage in South Carolina?
Well, you know, this is a military town. Fort Jackson is here. It's the biggest basic training base. We know people here who go to war, and we feel it. But the question is what does our defense dollar go to? Where does our leadership tell us to go? When this tragedy occurred, our president said, go out and go shopping. It's truly a tragedy.
David, thanks for your call. Let me turn to David Kennedy in California. David Kennedy, Vice President Cheney, saying yesterday critics of the Iraq War are undermining the resolve of the American people. Ben Wattenberg says if the media in World War II were as tough on the Washington as it is today, we would have been in big trouble then. Does that ring true to you?
Well, I think when Vice President Cheney says the media are undermining the unity of the American people, that's correct. That the sense of the consensus about national purpose in this endeavor has eroded. I don't think it's the media's fault. I think it's the fault of the facts on the ground. And as Doris rightly says, the chronic inability of the president and the administration generally to explain in a convincing and persuasive way exactly what is at stake here, why it's worth this level of effort and so on. So I don't think it's the media's fault, but I do think it is a fact that this kind of consensus, the kind of consensus that the country enjoyed extravagantly in the World War II era, virtually unanimous consent about the justice and rightness of that war, we see nothing similar here. And though the administration hates the analogy, the proper analogy, it seems to me, is Vietnam, when, again, a majority of the American public came to believe that that was a sadly and badly mistaken policy and had to be ended.
Cindy's calling from Washington. Hi, Cindy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. On this media question, I'm actually disappointed that the media hasn't been tougher and more aggressive on the lies that have been told to us. Let me give you one quick example. Last week in the front page of the Washington Post, there was a story where a Senate committee had investigated and concluded that the CIA was telling President Bush and the administration that there was no link with Iraq, and that President Bush knew that. This was a page, but it was a one-column headline. I would have written that in my paper as a six-column screaming headline saying, it's been proven that we were lied to about the reasons that we've sacrificed trillions of dollars and thousands of American and Iraqi lives.
So don't go after the media. You say have a louder media looking more closely. Ben Wattenberg, this goes to your point. There's pushback here. What do you say?
Well, with all due respect, I think that's preposterous. First of all, the idea of going into Iraq was not a secret. Paul Wolfowitz was writing public papers about it in the late 1980s and the early 1990s.
But it was not presented to the American people as an idea predating 9/11.
That is not correct. It became the NSSM, the National whatever Security Memo, that was rejected in the early 1990s because it said that America should prevent other regional powers from threatening the United States has been adopted. I don't think that President Bush has knowingly told a single lie. The idea that this is some hardware war, the much maligned Don Rumsfeld. Don Rumsfeld and I were on the board of Freedom House, which was measures democracy and representative government around the world. And he is an idealist as well as a realist. And one final point. You know, 4 days before the election in 2000, then Governor Bush, it was revealed by whom no one really knows that he was DUI, driving under intoxication. And according to Karl Rove,
as a younger man,
he lost. He was driving too slowly, by the way. That Karl Rove estimates that that cost him about 4 points in the polls. Now, what would happen if 4 days or a week before these elections, Osama bin Laden was nabbed or killed, who, by the way, allegedly was in the crosshairs of President Clinton, but in allegedly a wag the dog tail, he opted out.
That's exactly the thing that's been so stridently refuted, in the last week by Clinton and others. But Doris Kearns Goodwin, what about this issue of credibility? You hear it, the caller says she wants more honesty, more toughness, not less, and she's not feeling credibility from the nation's leadership. Here we are facing a big challenge with this credibility issue right in the heart of it. Is there precedent for that?
Well, you know, I think one of the moments that will be looked back on when we go over this maybe 50 years from now was the thinness of the debate that took place in the Congress when we went into Iraq. It seemed to me both Democrats and Republicans were so anxious for those midterm elections that they didn't allow a full debate to take place. I remember Senator Byrd saying, the halls of the Congress are silent. And I think what happens now even is that Democrats are still not certain about how loud to speak up on what to do, because it's unclear perhaps what to do, but because they're trying to posit where they should be because of politics. So it's getting very complicated, and I don't think there are strong voices. It would be one thing if you had a clear choice now for the American people about what we should do, but sadly, I don't think that's being presented.
Elijah's calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Elijah. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I'd just like to make a quick point that to me the most heartbreaking thing about 9/11 is the divide that's happened between the people of this country since then. It seems to be amplified by the talking heads, by our politicians, and I feel that Al-Qaeda and those who do seek to hurt us are manipulating that divide. I do not wish to foray into my politics on this issue. I just wish that today we could, come to some kind of a consensus, some kind of a way forward to be Americans once again and be the envy of the world instead of bitterly hated.
Elijah, we certainly feel that. I want to get another call here, if I may, from Medford, Massachusetts. Ivan is calling. Hi, Ivan, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what do you see, Ivan?
Well, what do I see? I see a country that has retreated into chauvinism, that has canceled educational programs, that has canceled opportunities for international exchange, that has alienated the rest of the world with its arrogance. I see a country.
Is that so surprising, given what happened 5 years ago today, Ivan, that the country would become a little more closed?
It is surprising because America, the America that I emigrated to as not as an economic refugee, but as someone that went to American schools abroad, believed in all the American propaganda, and that's what attracts people. And America has always had a corporate foreign policy where it has denied human rights to other countries and other societies. And finally, other societies, when America, right after 9/11, they have seen that America really, it's just like them. And America has given them every reason for them to think worse of America, running secret prisons, denying civil rights, a government that is not a fully, truly working democracy where the president doesn't listen to Congress, that avoids laws, running secret a suppression of civil rights.
It's a tough list, and we hear it from an immigrant who came attracted by those ideals. David Kennedy, the president, and his inner circle have been making the case very loudly in recent days. You know that we are in war. We have to keep this. We've got to win it. We've got to keep it going. There's not an alternative. 5 years on, they're still making the case. They're still working to persuade Americans of the cause. What do you make of the duration of that effort? I mean, it hasn't been easy for all presidents to take the country to war. FDR had his own trouble with it before Pearl Harbor. But what do you make of how long that's taken and the debate over it even now?
Well, you're absolutely right. The debate still goes on. I think we would have been better served as a people, and indeed the world community would have been better served if the Bush administration's deeper reasons for the Iraq endeavor had been made clear at a much earlier point. I do believe there was a, at least in the abstract, an admirable grand strategy that lay behind the Iraq invasion, which is to create a model democracy in the region on the hope that that would democratize the region more generally and make those nations better members of the world community. But conspicuously, Doris refers to the thinness of congressional debate on the Iraq matter when it first came up. I think the administration has to take a lot of responsibility for failing to make that rationale for the war much more central to its case at that time. Then I think we could have had a real searching debate about how realistic and how plausible was that as an objective, and did we really have the resources necessary to that highly ambitious task? Mm. But instead, we are offered other reasons for the war.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, if I may, in recent days, former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich has looked back to one of your areas of focus, the Civil War. He says, quoting Abraham Lincoln about how we have to think anew, the time it took Lincoln to awake to the scale of the challenge in front of the country, let alone the entire people. Newt Gingrich says, we're in World War III here, and we've got to hurry up and wake up. It's 5 years. Same question to you, really, about the process of defining challenges to Americans and the duration of time it takes for those to sink in. There's a very different scale here between the build to the Civil War and the build or continuing effort to sell this one.
Well, I mean, Gingrich is right. There were many people in the early days of the Civil War who thought it would only last for 90 days. And it took much leadership on Lincoln's part as it became clear that this war was going to be much more terrible, much more long-lasting, to keep the support of the American people in what at the time even seemed like a total war. So I think the disconnect now is if President Bush is right that we are in the decisive ideological struggle of the 21st century, then our country is not mobilized to fight that kind of a struggle. You know, just going back to what David said, I mean, I think he's absolutely right. It may well be that President Bush had a reasonable and an idealistic hope, actually, of creating this democratic stable government in the middle of the Middle East. And if he had argued that, if that had been part of the debate, then think of how much energy we've put into this whole question of were there weapons of mass destruction? No, there weren't. So much of our imagination, our time, our energy, our debate has been focused on that. If that hadn't been the rationale in the first place, and we'd still agreed to go in, he might still have the country behind him because that struggle is still ongoing to possibly create a democracy in Iraq.
Let's take a call with a question for Ben Wattenberg. Gwen, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to express my concern about something that Mr. Wattenberg pointed out earlier regarding this recent statements. I believe there's an ABC documentary that came out, a two-day documentary, the lead up to September 11th. Which
not a documentary, but a kind of fictionalized recreation, the path
much.
To 9/11.
Fictionalized,
yes.
Recreation, which people will look at and perceive as being, take as a documentary, you know, they will believe it as fact, and it includes statements about Madeleine Albright and Clinton, and they're not following through on taking out bin Laden. They, unlike many conservatives, were not given preview copies of the documentary. They were not allowed to refute it. Even if they sue after the fact, you'll have this misperception by millions of American people who may watch this, coupled with Bush's speeches on terrorism and bin Laden and reminding us about this. And then perhaps they trot out bin Laden just before the elections. My concern is, are the American people, is the press going to do their job and point out how absurd this is? They may have bin Laden already.
Do you really think so? I think we might have heard something about that, but let us pick it up. Ben, I mean, there's the complaint. I mean, where's bin Laden? Not captured at all, but scarcely mentioned by the president for several years, now mentioned quite prominently.
Let me go through a couple of things as quickly as I can. I'm joined in the booth here with my research assistant at AI, Joe Manzari, who's a 22-year-old Iranian-American. And just to put it briefly, when the caller said people should pack up and go, he just waved and said, you know, bye-bye. The other thing is this asymmetrical warfare often continues almost forever. The IRA, the Basques, the Corsicans, the Palestinians, and the Israelis. It's not going to end. Timothy McVeigh. We've had it domestic. We've had it foreign. And just as Newt Gingrich is a colleague of mine here at AI, and I admire and respect him, but I just think he's wrong about that. And just as a point of information,
wrong on what front, Ben? That we should see this as World War III or something else?
Yeah. Well, it's just a factual point. I mean, Elliot Cohen at CSIS, I think, coined it that it's World War IV, that World War I was World War I, and World War II was World War II, and the Cold War was the Third World War.
I'm not sure the number matters, but are you seeing
and
it as World War?
And the War on Terror is World War IV. It's just a point of information.
Let me take a call from Valerie in Brookline, Massachusetts.
Good morning. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
The comments are for anyone to respond to. I wonder if the United States has lost its will to fight. There is a very perceived enemy, and yet the President of the United States declares a war, quotes, and the American people go on life as usual. Unless you have a son or a husband or a father who is fighting, the war seems to be just an annoyance.
And why do you think that is? Is it because of the way the president's framed it? Is it because the American people themselves don't have the taste for it? Why do you think it is, Valerie?
I think it's because of the president framed it. There was a definite Pearl Harbor moment that was not used. When September 11th happened, I'm not sure what made it happen this way, but it was not perceived in the same way as the attack on Pearl Harbor. This was an attack on U.S. soil. These are people who are not just intent on hurting us. They are intent on killing all of us, whether they do it here or other parts of the world. And I'm mystified at people's attitude about not being more behind this.
Valerie, thanks for your call. Doris Kearns Goodwin, our time is short. It's been 5 years, and we're painted a vista of many more years to come. You've studied how Americans have turned in their attitudes toward challenges before. Where do you imagine the country turning on this one? Can you paint as a historian some kind of trajectory out of the five-year response we've seen so far?
Well, I think there's still the capacity in the American people, if the leadership calls on them, to respond if they feel a challenge. I mean, we looked at what George Washington was able to do at Valley Forge and the country eventually winning that revolution. We looked at what happened in the Civil War. We've seen what happened in World War II. Proper leadership, a call for action, this country has always responded. I mean, that's one of the things that Churchill said about us, quoting an earlier British leader, saying the United States is a gigantic boiler, but once it's fired, something like that, you can't stop it. So I still have faith in the people here, if the leadership calls on us to respond in a way that we feel is necessary to this huge challenge, if it is a huge challenge in the world at large.
David Kennedy, is it going to take a reframing of the challenge to get Americans more solidly behind the national response?
Well, I think the short answer is it would take nothing more than another terrorist attack to reintroduce a high degree of national consensus. But, you know, I think there's a deeper structural issue that lies behind this, that we've become increasingly a disarticulated society with less sense of our shared purpose generally with respect to terrorism or what have you. And I'm remembering a famous remark of Mark Twain's when he said that any man worth his salt will fight to defend his home, but who will fight to defend his boarding house? And just to the extent that as a society we increasingly think we're merely boarders and tenants here and not really members of a common enterprise, just to that extent it's difficult to get us to agree on anything that takes the level of commitment that a protracted struggle of this sort does.
Ben Wattenberg, we've just got a few seconds. You were an optimist even in the Vietnam War. Do you see cause for optimism now?
I wasn't an optimist. I think I was a realist. It's a very interesting factoid that at every point during the Vietnam War, at least a plurality supported whatever policy the president was pursuing. This propaganda warfare is nothing new. In the age of the DVD, I saw again the movie Gandhi with Ben Kingsley, and he purposely tells his demonstrators to wait until the train bringing in the English
There's a
press.
Name to ponder today. With that, we're out of time. Ben Wattenberg at the American Enterprise Institute, David Kennedy at Stanford University, and Doris Kearns Goodwin, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.